From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He was the original unstoppable gumshoe, though one suspects he wore fine leather. Driven by logic, sworn to science, the super-rational, supreme detective who personified an age. And more than a century after his Victorian-era creation, the world still can't get enough of the great Sherlock Holmes. Tonight on Point, the game is afoot, the magic of and the mind behind the mysteries of Sherlock Holmes. But first tonight, mixed news on the economic front. The fourth quarter of 2004 saw a swelling trade deficit and slowed growth to 3.1%. Looking back on all of 2004, the numbers out this week were more encouraging. The economy grew 4.4%, its best performance since 1999. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal and joins me now from Washington. So, what's up, Greg?
Tom, as you just mentioned, it's kind of actually a good news, bad news story. The good news is that if you look at the year as a whole, it was a very good year for the economy. We grew 4.4%. That's the best rate since 1999. And it's also one of the strongest rates of growth in the industrialized world. But if you actually look at how the year progressed, it was a story of a steady kind of erosion, so that by the time we finished the year, we were only growing at a 3.1% annual rate. What's the problem here? Well, it's not that consumers are spending less. And in fact, consumer spending grew at a very healthy rate of 4.6% on an annualized basis in the fourth quarter. The problem is that they are spending a lot of that money not on stuff we produce here in the United States, but on imports. The trade deficit widened to a record level in the fourth quarter. That is a consistent hurdle that we have had to deal with in this economic recovery, the fact that so much of our growth is being, as it were, drained into a demand for foreign instead of domestic products.
Of course, we've had a big trade deficit for a long time. Is it reaching some kind of tipping point here, Greg?
There's certainly concerns like that, Tom. We heard Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, last November in Europe warning that the deficit was reaching unsustainable levels. The basic problem is that at these levels, we are forced to borrow about $2 billion a day from foreigners just to finance our excessive demand for foreign goods and services.
But that's not something that can be turned around in a hurry. What can be done about it?
Well, Tom, I think something is being done about it already in the sense that the dollar, as you and I have talked about before, has been sliding now for 2 or 3 years. Now, that obviously hasn't made much of a difference yet, but these things do with time turn things around. It took about 2 years in the 80s for a big drop in the dollar to start to narrow our trade deficit, and most of the economists think that with the customary 2 to 3 year lag, the decline in the dollar we've had over the last 2 or 3 years will start to turn things around next year.
You mean that those manufacturing and other jobs that have gone to China and India are going to come back to the United States because of the lower dollar?
It's probably a bit much to expect that the 2 million or so manufacturing jobs that we have lost since the recession are going to be coming back. But I think we can expect a couple of small things. One is that the loss of jobs is going to slow, if not stop, altogether. The other thing is that we are already seeing signs that businesses in the United States that had lost sales overseas are starting to get them back. They are actually able to undercut the prices that some of their competitors from Europe and other countries, such as Canada and Latin America, had been charging. And that means that with time, their profits will improve, and perhaps they'll be hiring more.
But if the dollar is down and maybe falls further, what about that $2 billion a day that the U.S. is currently borrowing to keep things in balance?
Well, it's kind of a delicate balancing act, Tom. Essentially, we have to keep foreigners purchasing that $2 billion a day in stocks and bonds and other assets from us without giving the impression that the investments that they just purchased are going to suddenly collapse in value because the dollar is falling. So that is why you will hear the Bush administration constantly saying they are in favor of a strong dollar, even though at the back of their minds they realize that a weaker dollar is probably helping to improve the economic outlook in the long run. They do not want to give anyone out there the impression that they are trying to get the dollar to fall, because that could be just asking for trouble. The next thing you'd know, people would be dumping those stocks and bonds en masse, stock prices would be plunging, interest rates would be shooting up, and the economic outlook would be much darker.
Greg, it's the time of year when people who are lucky enough are thinking about cost of living adjustments. What's the story with inflation these days?
Inflation, the story again, is a little bit of a mixed picture. If you were to look at what we call the overall headline inflation rate, that includes everything we buy, it's still running at over over 3% on the last monthly data we have. And that is largely because there has been a big increase in gasoline prices, heating oil prices, natural gas prices. But if you actually take out that big jump in energy prices, the underlying inflation rate, what they call the core inflation rate, is only running at around 2%. And in fact, it has been in that region for, you know, 4 or 5 years now. And the betting, at least at the Federal Reserve, is that as long as energy prices stop going up, the overall inflation rate is going to stabilize in that 2% area. And that'll be good news for a couple of reasons. One, mainly, it'll stop eroding the paycheck of all the working Americans out there. But number two, it also means the Federal Reserve will not feel compelled to raise interest rates dramatically, which could have terribly negative effects on the housing market and other parts of the economy.
Nobody wants to see that yet. It may be out there. Greg Ipp, thanks so much for the economic report.
Okay, Tom. Have a great weekend.
You too. Greg Ipp covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Washington. Victorian London. It's a cold night under a bright moon, and in the window above, the figure of a man with deerstalker cap and magnifying glass studies the lurid and murderous streets below.
Detection is and ought to be an exact science. Observation, deduction, a cold, unemotional subject. You have attempted to tinge it with romanticism, which has much the same effect as if you'd worked a love story or an elopement into the fifth proposition of Euclid.
He is, of course, Sherlock Holmes, the most famous sleuth in English fiction, and 118 years after his adventures with Dr. Watson first hit the magazine pages of Victorian England, Holmes remains an iconic character the world over. His cunning, his keen observation, his startling powers of deduction, Sherlock Holmes epitomized the supreme man of science, the brilliant, brainy detective with the humble scribe and sidekick who never left a case unsolved. From A Study in Scarlet to The Musgrave Ritual to The Hound of the Baskervilles, Holmes fought his way to glory. His creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, tried to kill him off in 1893. His readers rioted in the streets of London. So Doyle brought him back and made the stories of Sherlock Holmes immortal. Our guest tonight knows the magic of the Holmes mysteries. He spent years creating the most extensive annotated edition of the complete Holmes short stories ever produced. Tonight on Point, Inside the Marvelous Mysteries of Sherlock Holmes, you can join the conversation. What's your favorite Sherlock Holmes story? And more than a century after his creation, why is the world still so charmed by this coolly calculating detective? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from the studios of NPR West in Los Angeles is Leslie Klinger, editor of the massive new two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, The Complete Short Stories. Leslie Klinger, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Now I've looked through these volumes. They're amazing, all these short stories, and the most incredible detail of annotation. I mean, it brings not only Sherlock Holmes to life, but the Victorian era in which he lived and every kind of different inflection of language and hansom cab and haberdashery and, for that matter, opium usage. I mean, you've got it all here. What's the source of your, what I would have to say is a fairly clear obsession with Sherlock Holmes?
This started for me when I was in law school. I was desperate to read something other than law books all the time, and I was lucky enough to discover the annotated Sherlock Holmes by William Baring-Gould, a massive two-volume set that had been published in 1967 that did much the same thing that I've tried to do here. And I just got hooked, my little twisted mind, by those footnotes and loved the information that they conveyed about Sherlockian scholarship, this careful study of these stories. And as you say, the treasures of the Victorian era that are embedded in the stories.
You are, by day job, by trade, an accountant. So this is a big field of, kind of Elysian field for you to romp in.
Actually, a tax lawyer.
Excuse me.
The deductions are very similar, yes.
Okay.
The legal skills of analyzing a mass of evidence and sifting through it and trying to balance out the various elements, I think it was very helpful to me in doing these annotations. What I've tried to do here, I frequently say there's not a lot of clinger in this book. There's a lot of summation of other people's writing. There's been a tremendous amount of scholarship written by fans of these stories. Over the last 100-plus years, I've tried to distill it into these notes. Plus, I did add a great deal of sort of additional Victorian cultural information that I found in a multitude of great sources, contemporary books, Encyclopedia Britannica from 1888, travel guides, things like that.
Leslie Klinger, I wish you'd do us a favor. We want to get kind of a bead on what it is that draws you to Sherlock Holmes, and you might also help get us back into the world of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Holmes. I wish you'd give us a couple of your favorite moments from particular stories. Set up the story for us and take us to moments that illuminate what it is that draws you to Sherlock Holmes. Take us into a couple.
Sure. There's a couple that I think, to me, they're personal favorites. There are dozens that others might suggest. One is in a story called Silver Blaze, one of the best of the stories. It's a story about a racehorse that's gone missing, and Holmes has been called in to investigate. And he draws Watson's attention, he says, to the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. Watson, innocently enough, replies, "But Holmes, the dog did nothing in the nighttime," meaning that the dog didn't bark or do anything outlandish. Mm. Holmes says, "That was the curious incident."
the un-incident. One
hand
clapping.
This is a wonderful exchange showing the pithy wit of Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, it is a brilliant bit of deduction, which leads to the conclusion that the perpetrator was someone familiar with the dog, and so the dog didn't bark at him when he came there.
But 1892, remind us of the crime in Silver Blaze.
Silver Blaze, the crime is a murder. It's the death of, and of course the story is a wonderful story because the murder turns out to have been committed by the horse.
Of course, elementary, my dear. And give us another favorite moment. What story, what moment?
Sure. Here's another one. It's my favorite story, I must say. The story is called The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, and a carbuncle is a gem. And as the story begins, it's the day after Christmas, Boxing Day. Watson has come to see Holmes at his flat to wish him compliments of the season. And part of the appeal of this whole story is just the atmosphere of it. They're very, very Victorian. Holmes is lying on his lounge examining a hat, a battered old hat. Mm. And he gives it to Watson and says, "What do you observe about the hat?" Well, Watson makes a few remarks about it. Holmes takes it back and makes a string of amazing deductions based on the battering of the hat, the age of the hat, the style of the hat, the hat band, lime cream on the inside of the hat band, the fact that this belonged to an older man with grizzled hair who is out of shape, etc. It's this incredible series of deductions, all of which turn out to be true when we meet the character later. Now, it starts innocently enough, but it turns out to be a dire crime. An innocent man has been jailed for the theft of the blue carbuncle. Strangely enough, the carbuncle is shortly in Holmes's hands because it's been found inside a goose that his neighbor, the commissionaire, has found on the street along with this hat. So the hat turns out to be very important to link the goose to the owner of the goose and hence to trace backwards how the gem got into the goose, who stole the goose. It's a brilliant story. It's a wonderful story.
Strange tales indeed. And I have to admit, from your annotations, I learned that a carbuncle was a gem. I thought it was something that grew on your foot. Little did I know.
But I saved for last what has to be, I think, for many, the highlight of all the stories. And let me put it into the context.
Terrific. Hold that as a mystery through this break, because we have to take it, and we'll wonder what you're going to tell us. Leslie Klinger, editor of the new two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes, we're talking tonight about the great Victorian-era detective. You can join the conversation. Do you know the grip of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle? Have you surrendered to the world of Sherlock Holmes? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the great Victorian-era detective hero Sherlock Holmes and the cult of Sherlock Holmes. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you lost yourself in The Hound, The Baskervilles, The Speckled Band, The Blue Carbuncle? And what is it that makes the character of Holmes, the allure of his world, so endlessly appealing to so many? And maybe this, be honest, who are you? Holmes? Watson? Moriarty? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's just hear a bit from the 1959 movie adaptation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Here, Holmes, played by Peter Cushing, shows off his remarkable powers of deduction.
Dr. Mortimer, it was something more important that brought you all the way from Devonshire to Baker Street. Something that occurred on Dartmoor on Friday, the 13th of June.
You've known about it all the time, then?
I know nothing, except that you live on Dartmoor. That you have a copy of the Devon County Chronicle in your briefcase, dated June the 14th. That newspaper is published on Saturdays, but goes to press on Thursdays. You've kept it for something vitally important. There is nothing of particular interest in the headlines, therefore it must be in the stop press. So, whatever it was happened on the Friday the 13th of June.
But this is remarkable.
Superficial. There's nothing remarkable about using one's eyes.
Deduction, 1959, The Hound of the Baskervilles. My guest tonight, Leslie Klinger, joins us from NPR West in Los Angeles. He's editor of the new two-volume set, The Annotated Sherlock Holmes, The Complete Short Stories. And Leslie Klinger, we interrupted you in the middle of your third favorite moment from the great body of Holmes. Bring it to us.
Let me say also, by the way, that's a lovely script. It's not in the story. It's an original piece of deduction written for the script that you just played.
Okay. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle would not recognize that one.
But would applaud it. I want to put this story into the context that you've mentioned at the top of the show, and that is that as far as the reading public knew, in 1893, let me say, the story called The Final Problem was published. And in 1893, what the readers of the Strand magazine learned was that Sherlock Holmes had actually died in 1891, that he had gone over the falls at the Reichenbach with Professor Moriarty. Mm. As you pointed out, it wasn't until 1901 that the English public got any further information about Holmes when the reminiscence called The Hound of the Baskervilles was published. Mm-hmm. In 1903 now, we come to the electrifying event recounted in the story, The Adventure of the Empty House, probably, for me, the most emotional of all the stories in the canon. Holmes has been missing. It's now 1894, and Watson has decided to take up the investigation of the murder of Ronald Adair.
Watson, no less, on his own. Brave Watson.
On his own. Holmes is gone. He has mm-hmm. He's lost his friend.
Over the falls.
So in 1894, he is searching out some clues. He's walking around this murder which took place in Park Lane, and he bumps into an old bookseller who offers him some books. He then goes back to his own apartment, and the bookseller, to his surprise, has followed him home and has now sort of made his way into Watson's study.
Strange.
And is commenting to Watson that he has a gap on the shelf, that these books the old bookseller mm-hmm. is carrying would just fit. Watson turns to look at the gap on the shelf, and when he turns back toward the bookseller, there stands Sherlock Holmes. Holmes has returned from the dead, and he explains to Watson that how he got out of those falls at Reichenbach was that he was never in them. But Watson recounts that for the one and only time in his life, he fainted dead away.
Poor Watson on the floor, but Holmes is back and back in business, and many, many more stories follow that, the revival of Sherlock Holmes. Leslie Klinger, I wish you'd... There's a lot of basics we want to understand here. First of all, who was Arthur Conan Doyle? Why did he... Why and how did he begin to write these stories? When? For whom? What engendered Sherlock Holmes?
Doyle was a physician. He went to medical school in Edinburgh, and he was a natural-born storyteller. He started writing stories on a number of different topics. He was a science fiction writer. We would class some of the stories as horror, mystery, domestic fiction. He had written several novels of domestic life. Most importantly, from his point of view, he was a writer of historical romances, fiction. He wrote a novel called Micah Clark. He wrote a novel called Rodney Stone about the Regency era, and his favorite, a novel called The White Company about medieval times and knights and that sort of thing.
How old was he in 1887 when he wrote the first Holmes story, Study in Scarlet?
In his young 20s. And he had this idea. He knew the writing of Edgar Allan Poe very well. He wanted to create a rational detective. He had the brilliant idea to combine the detective with a human, warm, intelligent sidekick, Dr. Watson. This is something that Dupin lacked. Poe's detective Dupin, his companion, is very colorless, and we don't really have a connection to Dupin because of that. So he wrote this story, A Study in Scarlet. It was a very difficult sell. He peddled it to a number of magazines. Although he'd had some success with getting stories published, he really ran into a stone wall with this. He ended up selling it outright to Beaton's, Samuel Beaton's publishing. It appeared in Beaton's Christmas Annual in 1887, and it certainly wasn't a significant commercial success. He then went on to do other things. In 1889, he was approached by an American publisher, Lippincott's magazine, who, along with Oscar Wilde, the two of them were asked to contribute stories, novel length, or what we would call now long stories, novella, to Lippincott's magazine. Oscar Wilde produced The Picture of Dorian Gray.
1890.
Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle produced a story called The Sign of the Four, a wonderful, very cinematic story about blowguns and pygmies and chase down the Thames and a lost treasure and the Indian mutiny and murder and a terrific story. But again, it achieved some success. It was a big success in America, but it didn't really electrify the public. But in 1891, Doyle started to write short stories about Sherlock Holmes. He submitted these to the Strand magazine, which was a new venture, a new idea, a magazine that would have a picture on every other page. The Strand editors loved these stories. And it was a marriage made in heaven. The Strand and Doyle became immense commercial successes. He wrote a series of six stories, then another six. The Strand commissioned more. He wrote another 12 stories. And then, as we've discussed, in the last story of that series, called The Final Problem in 1893, he killed off Sherlock Holmes.
And he said, I forget the words exactly, I read in your annotation something about if he didn't kill Holmes, Holmes was going to kill him.
Yes.
Why?
He thought that he had better things to do. He basically thought that his main calling was to write historical fiction. And he did a fine job of that, although, unfortunately, those books are little read today. He wrote the Brigadier Gerard stories, which are lovely tales of the Napoleonic era. He eventually wrote the Professor Challenger series, The Lost World, a very well-known novel made into a film a number of times, and a couple other Challenger novels. But he always had a low opinion of the Holmes stories. He felt that they were potboilers, commercial.
Potboilers, but the public loved them and would not let him quit and made him bring Holmes back effectively from the dead. You've got an introduction here from John le Carré, the British spy novelist. He writes about Dr. Watson. He says, Dr. Watson doesn't write to you. He talks to you with Edwardian courtesy across a glowing fire. His voice has no barriers or affectations. It's the clear, energetic, and decent, the voice of a Tweedy, no-nonsense, colonial Britisher at ease with himself. You say that's his great innovation. But what about the character of Holmes himself, the rational detective? This seems like such an epitome of the kind of scientific ethos emerging in the Victorian time.
Absolutely, and I think that was the tremendous appeal to the British public at that time, was that they very much wanted to believe that science could solve crime and could bring aid to those who needed it. We have to remember that the whole idea of a police force was a very new invention. It only came about in the late 1830s. And the police were not particularly scientific. They were coming along. They had begun to use the method called anthropometry, or Bertillon system of measuring criminals' physical measurements, ears and noses and height
that old
weight and all that.
The criminal physique. Or just to identify them.
Yes, but only exactly, just to identify them. And that was really sort of the first great scientific advance in criminology. The Holmes stories really introduced a number of new ideas. The idea of plaster casts for footprints, even the idea of using fingerprints as a way to confirm someone's identity. But a lot of those techniques were new in the stories. The public loved this idea that the police could function in a scientific manner and solve crime, as I say.
So there's the science, and there the man of science, the detective of science, and that's all great. But of course, after all that rationality and the cool deduction, which everybody loved, it made the personal quirks and characteristics of Holmes all the more appealing set against that. Give us some of those. You say, for start, right out of the first story, or out of, I guess, A Scandal in Bohemia, he's a cocaine addict.
Yes, and before we judge that too harshly, we have to remember the context. Cocaine, morphine, these kinds of drugs were routinely available at the local chemist shop.
It was in Coca-Cola.
in at least according to urban legend. But right. It was certainly in a number of over-the-counter, widely mm-hmm. available remedies. Coca wine, for example, was sold as a medicine. And if you read the Britannica, the 1888 Britannica on cocaine, it talks about how it eliminates fatigue, sharpens the mind. Watson.
So when Doyle made Sherlock Holmes a cocaine addict, what did that signal to the readers? That this is an especially sharp-witted man because he's...
Well, it did signal that he was a bohemian. It still wasn't a very acceptable thing to do, but nonetheless, it wasn't an addiction. It wasn't perceived as an addiction or a sickness mm-hmm. or a weakness. Mm-hmm. Although Watson is astute enough to recognize that it has dangers, and he quickly begins to try to wean Holmes from the drug. He was very advanced thinking in doing that. There was very little known about the addictive nature of opium or cocaine and those, and it was certainly not recognized as a great problem. Although in one of the stories, we do see an opium addict, and Watson has to go rescue his friend from the opium dens.
And what else do we know about the character, the personal quirks of Holmes?
Well, he smoked
of course,
like a
the pipe
chimney.
Is always there.
The pipe, cigarettes, cigars.
Oh.
The meerschaum pipe that shows up in later iconic images
the
of
big,
Holmes
curvaceous
is not
pipe.
True.
Not
right,
true.
That's a false image.
Uh-huh.
Also, the deerstalker. The deerstalker is only mentioned, the hat. That is
with the flaps and tied on top and all
that. It's an invention of the stage. It only appears in one of the hundreds of illustrations. It's not really mentioned in any of the stories.
But he must have worn a hat at that time. What sort of hat?
Of course, but he would have worn a top hat. He was a professional gentleman, so he would have worn a frock coat and a top hat. And Jeremy Brett, the actor that we heard playing Holmes a bit before, was very careful to dress Holmes properly, as an English gentleman would have.
Let's hear just a little bit more from Jeremy Brett and maybe keep Holmes in our conversation here. I've got a little clip here from the 1984 adaptation of The Sign of the Four. Jeremy Brett's thought to be one of the best actors ever to play Holmes. Here he's admonishing Watson, played by Edward Hardwick, for letting his judgment cloud over for the beauty of a woman.
What a very attractive woman. It is of the first importance not to allow your judgment to be biased by personal qualities. A client to me is a mere unit, a factor of the problem. Holmes, you're an automaton, a calculating machine. There's something positively inhuman in you at times. I assure you, the most winning woman I ever knew was hanged for poisoning three little children for their insurance money. And the most repellent man of my acquaintance is a philanthropist who has spent nearly $250,000 upon the London poor.
However, in this case, Holmes,
I never make exceptions. An exception disproves the rule. I'm going out. I'll see you in an hour.
The Sign of Four, 1984. Jeremy Britt, they're playing Holmes, and Watson says, Holmes, you're an automaton, a calculating machine.
Right. And Watson, of course, ends up marrying that very woman that he found so attractive. That's Mary Morstan. Holmes was exaggerating. He does have some use for women. He does say women are never to be trusted, not the best of them. But he certainly admired Irene Adler. He admired Maud Bellamy, who shows up in one of the very late stories. And he treats women with courtesy. He is not the misogynist that I think that he is often characterized as. But he could be cold and rational. He could be bohemian, over the top. He doesn't always treat Watson very well.
Did he have a woman? Did he have lovers in the stories?
No.
Never.
No. And I think I've been asked many times about Holmes' sexuality. Was he gay? Did he have a homosexual relationship with Watson? What about Irene Adler? Did he really have an illegitimate child named Nero Wolfe with Irene Adler? My answers are no, that Holmes was too busy. He basically felt that those kinds of emotions would be like grist in his mill, that they would cloud his judgment and distract him from his professional work. And so he put those kinds of emotions aside.
He had a job to do, didn't want sand in the gears. Leslie Klinger, stand by. We've got callers who want to join us. Frank's calling from Salisbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I just want to say I'm in the middle of reading this annotated Leslie Klinger edition, and I love it.
It's something, really, isn't it?
It's really a wonderful book. My only complaint is it's heavy, and I read it at night. And
well,
I have to you have to place a pillow on your chest, because otherwise your arms get too tired. You can't hold the
You don't want to be found dead in the morning. They might have to call in a detective
That's
to figure
right.
that
and
out.
But we did spare you. We did spare you by putting the four novels into a third volume. Otherwise, this would have been 15 pounds.
No, it's great. And then the whole bound set, I got it for Christmas from my son, who I read these stories to when he was a boy, and I always read them out loud as a child.
So what are you learning in here, Frank, in
these
annotated?
I'm learning all sorts of things. I mean, you know, I have no complaints at all. The only thing is it's if you had never read the stories before, it might be a little distracting because the footnotes are so wonderful, and it's laid out so well.
I agree with you. And I think in one of the notes or prefaces or something, I suggested that for those who had not read the story before, they read the story first and then go back and read the notes.
Yeah, and for me, you know, I know the stories and I love the footnotes, and it takes a long time because you want to read them all, and it's just terrific. The only other thing I wanted to say is that the front matter in the first volume, the preface and the world of Sherlock Holmes, and is a wonderfully concise, I think, beautifully written short history of Victorian England in a way, and a terrific introduction to the books, but just to the whole era. And
Thank you. Just
a wonderful job. That's really all I had to say. Is just thank you for a terrific, terrific book,
Frank. It's a beautiful compliment, and thanks for calling it in. Do your friends look at you, Leslie Klinger, and say, Dr. Watson, you are obsessed?
Yes. They have for many, many years, and you know, but they understand it's a benign obsession. It's my children have been scouts for me for many years, finding
scouts?
All kinds of strange things. Well, you know, I need people to go out there and say, "There's a book that Les maybe doesn't have. I'll buy it for him."
Right. So they keep bringing it home, and you keep weaving it all into the annotations.
That's right. Actually, the great pleasure is that when I started doing this, I have a vast collection of books about Sherlock Holmes. But when I started doing this, I started expanding that to be Victorian books. So guidebooks, dictionaries, map books, all kinds of strange Victorian books.
We're going to come back and talk more about the atmosphere, the ethos of that time, the Victorian time. Our subject tonight, the great Victorian-era detective and hero, Sherlock Holmes, and the cult of Sherlock Holmes. My guest, Leslie Klinger, editor of the new two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. You can join the conversation. Is the cool rationality of Holmes still magnetic to you today, or have we learned the limits of the rational, the scientific? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the great Victorian-era fictional detective Sherlock Holmes. My guest is Leslie Klinger, editor of the new two-volume set, The New Annotated Sherlock Holmes. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bernard's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Bernard. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind, Bernard?
Well, I just wanted to mention that I'm very interested in Sherlock Holmes, and I like how he always not only uses cool logic, but like in The Speckled Band, for instance, Sherlock, in the face of the onslaught of insults from the tall, imposing Dr. Grimsby,
yes,
he takes it all in stride and he gets to the point where he gets Dr. Grimsby so mad he actually goes and bends a steel fireplace poker in half, and after leaving, Holmes goes over and he just bends it right back, you know, as if nothing happened.
A tremendous feat, both bending and unbending, and it sounds like you know these stories inside and out, Bernard.
Yes, I've got several ones, but my question was from the same story, The Speckled Band, how the swamp adder is kept in a iron safe. And I was always wondering, in all the copies I have, it never mentions any sort of
holes. Air holes.
Air holes, yeah, I was always wondering
right.
about that.
Now, what is it that's in the iron safe, Leslie? What is
the
that?
The snake.
Again? Oh, the snake.
A snake.
I see.
A snake.
So Bernard's asking, how does it breathe, in other words?
That's right. And why does it drink milk? And there's a number of strange questions about this snake, and I think, Bernard, you've put your finger on one of the more important ones. There's no mention of air holes. Not that that doesn't mean they weren't there, but they're not mentioned. There's a lot of questions about that snake. It doesn't seem to behave in a very snake-like manner, but there has been a lot of speculation, and people have come up with stories of cobras being fed milk, this kind of snake that's been trained to climb a rope, and so on. There's a great deal to read about in those footnotes about what kind of snake was it and could it really have existed. I do love that scene, and if I'd had a list of four stories, I probably would have mentioned that very scene in which Dr. Roylott bends the poker, and Holmes, who comes across as not very intimidating in the scene, as soon as Roylott has left, picks up the poker and straightens it out. And, of course, the comparison is Roylott's this giant of a man, and Holmes is just normal size.
Bernard, we love the way you tell it, and thanks very much for calling in. Wally is calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Wally. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Yeah.
I read that Doyle was actually knighted not for the Holmes stories, but for his investigative reporting of King Leopold's atrocities in the Belgian Congo. And I wonder if there are examples in the Holmes stories of Holmes's social conscience. Did he take on any causes in his book, his stories, as Doyle did in his real life?
Mm. Leslie Klinger.
First, it wasn't the Belgian Congo. It was the Boer War. Actually, what Doyle wrote about was defending the British conduct of the Boer War. The British were widely criticized because, in fact, it was the first use of the concentration camp. The British had adopted those for the Boer prisoners. But Doyle rose to the defense and wrote a wonderful book about it, and that really is why he was knighted.
How did he defend the concentration camps? Was he apologist for them?
I wouldn't say apologist. He explained why it was necessary in the course of the war. And, of course, they weren't intended to be cruel things. They were intended really to protect the prisoners and keep them segregated. We're not talking about torture here.
And what about the issue of a social conscience in Doyle or in Sherlock Holmes?
Doyle was very active in many causes and, most importantly, spiritualism, which we'll get to. But he took up individual cases and attempted to act like Holmes would have. Holmes himself really never involved himself with social issues. He was above politics or outside politics and that sort of thing. And he focused on individual clients, never really on larger issues. Although certainly Holmes was a man who always did the right thing, whether it was what the law required or not.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was mocked for his spiritualism by some contemporaries. What was that all about? It seems a very Victorian thing as well, maybe the opposite end of the spectrum from the scientific mentality.
Yes, in some ways, but we have to put spiritualism back into its context.
Define it for us. It's kind of a gone thing, though.
It's essentially I guess I'd call it a religion or philosophy that focuses on communication with the dead.
The seance kind of thing.
Exactly, but It offered a great deal of comfort that the dead did live on and that we could communicate with them.
In a time this without antibiotics when lots of people died.
This is right. And we have to remember its heyday, its heights, was immediately following World War I when, of course, many, many families had lost a son or daughter in the war and very much wanted the comfort of knowing that they would be able to communicate with them. Doyle was intensely interested in this from the time of him being a young man. And spiritualism promised to be a scientific religion. It said you don't have to take this on faith. We can prove these things. And that was a great appeal to many people. Doyle became a believer. He saw proof where other people saw fraud, but he became really the leading spokesman in the world for the spiritualist cause and devoted a great deal of time and energy and money to it over the years.
Leslie Klinger, we've just got a minute remaining here. To describe to us how the saga came to an end. How does it close? The last Sherlock Holmes story and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
The final Sherlock Holmes story is set in 1914. It's on the eve of World War I. Holmes has actually come out of retirement. It's a story called His Last Bow, and he has just completed the exposure of a spy ring. It's a touching story because we see Holmes reunited with Watson, and Holmes looks to the future and sees a better world, as did many of the English, on the eve of the war, that the world, this would be the last war we'd have to fight, and everything would be right. Unfortunately, it's an ideal that proved to be false. We can all hope for that, but there you have it.
Well, it was a good read at the time, and right through. Leslie Klinger, we salute your obsession in what you've produced in this terrific, vast, annotated Sherlock Holmes, the complete short stories. We'll look for the novels. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you, and I can't say enough about how wonderful it is to have a Bernard call in and talk about these stories.
So. Absolutely. We'll second that. Here, here. Pip, pip, Bernard. Keep reading. Listeners, if you want to read some of the Sherlock Holmes stories, go to our website, onpointradio.org. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Early this morning, 30 Marines and one sailor of the 1st Marine Division and the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force died when their CH-53 Echo Super Stallion helicopter crashed near Aruba, Al-Anbar province here in Iraq.
These will be credible elections, maybe imperfect in certain ways given the environment we're talking about, but nevertheless a major improvement on what we have had before.
What we're trying to do here is provide security during the elections by working with the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. What we hope to do is give confidence to the Iraqi people to come out and vote in their elections.
We have reached the point that a prolonged American military presence in Iraq is no longer productive for either Iraq or the United States.
Now it's time to build on those achievements to make the world safer and even more free. We must use American diplomacy to help create a balance of power that favors freedom. The time for diplomacy is now.
I cannot endorse higher responsibilities for those who helped to set our great country down the path of increasing isolation, enmity in the world, and a war that has no end.
I expect my cabinet secretaries to make sure that that practice doesn't go forward. There needs to be independence. There needs to be a nice independent relationship between the White House and the press, and the administration and the press.
An encounter with this memory, Bishop, now you are the custodians of, must do something to you and through you the whole world and put an end to the curse of hatred, to the scourge of anti-Semitism.
We're walking down. I said, Johnny, let me ask you something, a little advice. How do you see my role down here tonight? And he said, Ed, I don't know how I see my own role. Let's just go down and entertain the hell out of
it. Yeah,
and boy, did he do that.
And there is a week. Wednesday marks the deadliest day yet for U.S. troops in Iraq. A total of 37 Americans perish, including 31 in a single helicopter crash. Preparations are underway for this weekend's elections in Iraq. Edward Kennedy becomes the first U.S. senator to call for a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. Condoleezza Rice is sworn in as Secretary of State, but not until after some harsh words from several senators, including West Virginia's Robert Byrd. President Bush calls for an end to the government payment of political pundits after conservative marriage researcher and columnist Maggie Gallagher acknowledged having done work for the administration. Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel speaks at the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And television icon Johnny Carson passes away at age 79. There's a week, Jack, plenty dead in Iraq, and the domestic agenda coming up as the president prepares for his State of the Union address.
Yes, he told the New York Times in an interview this week that he's going to address in more detail his Social Security privatization idea in the State of the Union. This comes amid polls that have sort of equivocal results. A Hart poll shows that if you tell people, are you in favor of investing private accounts in Social Security, it's about tied. On the other hand, if you explain to them that it's going to cost $1 trillion over a decade and that it would probably result in cut in the guaranteed benefit of 30% to 40%, then it becomes 54-40 against. The AARP, in one of their polls, of course they have their own viewpoint, say they only find 17% support for privatization if people know the real terms. Significantly, in the Hart poll, twice as many voters said they would punish a candidate as reward him for supporting privatization. And that's bound to get the attention of Republicans.
It will be a real test for President Bush's considerable ability to draw the picture around an issue like this. He's done it in the past and succeeded. Whether he can keep his version of the meaning of all this at forefront of the public's mind, a big question this time.
Yes, it is. And he's in a different political, there's an arrhythmia between his political situation and his parties. They, you know, everybody in Congress has to run for re-election. He's done with that. And so the calculations are just very different for them. And, the week began with prominent Republicans voicing suspicion or doubt about this. It's hard to say it's dead on arrival, but it certainly isn't healthy on arrival.
The Democrats sort of shaking off their despondency of the post-election weeks and months in this past week, Jack.
Yeah, a strong vote against Condoleezza Rice from Democrats, including a vote from Evan Bayh, the most moderate of senators. A poll among Democratic senators finds not a single one in favor of Social Security privatization. That's very significant because 12 Democratic senators supported the Bush tax cuts, and many Democratic senators supported the war, of course. And Harry Reid, and of course the vote in the Senate Judiciary Committee, all eight Democrats against Alberto Gonzalez's nomination for Attorney General. Harry Reid seems to have the new minority leader, the Democrats, seems to have brought some courage with him. He's from Nevada. He's a tough guy. He's a boxer. He once had to actually fight for his life when he was a member of the gaming commission out there when he was attacked. And he has he feels a little more secure than Tom Daschle did in that post. And the Democrats seem to be saying, well, we're going to oppose President Bush here. We're going to take the risk of seeming to be obstructionist on this Social Security privatization. And then they're going to vote strongly against Mr. Gonzalez.
That sort of first term post-9/11 flush of forced solidarity history.
I think that really is history. The tide has been going out on that for a long while, but so long as the president was running for re-election, people were leery. People didn't know how much power he had, and of course, it turned out he had enough power to really increase Republican turnout in South Dakota enough to get Tom Daschle out of office. So the Democrats had reason to be afraid.
And briefly, Jack, an interesting note out of China this week.
Yes, and possibly a historic one. The Chinese Central Bank saying, quote, we have lost faith in the American dollar. It is no longer a stable currency, has begun investing in a more stable basket of European currencies. And, of course, if this keeps up, who's going to pay for our current account deficit? And in order to attract them back, we're going to have to raise interest rates. That will slow the economy.
Stay tuned. A major buyer of treasuries there in Beijing. Jack Beattie, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skoke and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.